This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
All right, here we go. All right, so we got a little issue there technically. We'll get around it. It's no big deal. Welcome to the Steve Gruber Show. It's a Thursday morning. Thursday, we'll get cleaned up. Don't you worry about that. Not a problem. Thank you for stopping in. 888-900-9966 is the number to get connected. Brought to you this hour by AmericanMetalRoofs.com. AmericanMetalRoofs.com. And our giveaway for a new metal roof for your home at AmericanMetalRoofs.com. They're also hiring right now. So if you're looking for maybe a new job in sales, American Metal Roof, the place to be. Also in installation, so if you're, again, if you're looking for something new and a new job, well, this is the place. It's AmericanMetalRoofs.com. Thursday morning here on the program in Texas, residents there seeking safety. Those near the rivers being urged to evacuate because, well, the floods are out of control, frankly. The rain keeps coming. The rivers are already full, and there's no place for people to run to and hide. It's an absolute mess in Texas. Local officials urging residents to move. In Wharton, a town of approximately 8,800, located about 60 miles southwest of Houston, Mayor Domingo Montalvo asked residents who live in 300 homes on the west side of the city to voluntarily evacuate due to the predicted rise of the Colorado River. The National Weather Service reporting the river level at Wharton almost 36 feet as of 2 o'clock yesterday. The river was expected to top its 39-foot flood stage by early this morning, but isn't expected to crest until Friday at 46 feet, which would flood the homes as well as a school there. Our main concern, getting residents ahead of the game and giving them notice of voluntary evacuation. What a mess. I mean, it just continues to boil over. The problem is there's more rain in the forecast off and on for the next handful of days as well. At least 21 people in the United States have been killed, 14 more in Mexico. At least 8 people still missing in rural Hays County. That's after they discovered the body of a boy from the Blanco River and the body of a man discovered in the San Marcos River on Wednesday. In Houston itself, 7 people confirmed to have died in flooding that swept through the city Monday night. The latest victim identified as a 73-year-old woman who was reported missing by her family. And like I said, the rain keeps coming. Here in Michigan, I've noticed that we could use more rain. We could use more rain because, well, my pond is already seeming a bit dry. It's acting as if it were mid-August right now. That's my indicator. My indicator is my rain gauge, if you will, is my pond, and I think that's a pretty good one. U.S. military pilots carrying out an air war against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria are voicing growing discontent over what they say are heavy-handed rules of engagement hindering them from striking good targets. They blame a bureaucracy that does not allow for quick decision-making. One Navy F-18 pilot who has flown missions against ISIS voiced his frustration to news outlets, saying, "There were times I had groups of ISIS fighters in my sights and couldn't get the clearance to engage. They probably killed innocent people and spread evil because of my inability to kill them. It is frustrating." Well, when you have no foreign policy, and I'm sorry for the pilot, somebody who obviously excelled at what they did, went to school for a long time, volunteered to take his intelligence and abilities to the cockpit of an American fighter jet, and yet we have no cohesive foreign policy. Heck, we don't have any foreign policy to speak of. We don't have Hillary Clinton here to hit the reset button. Oh, yeah, how'd that work against Russia, by the way? Did it work out pretty well? A spokesman for the United States Air Force's Central Command pushed back, saying, "We refute the idea that close air support strikes take an hour on average. Depending on how complex the target environment is, a strike could take place in less than 10 minutes, or it could take much longer. As our leaders have said, this is a long-term fight, and we will not alienate civilians." Well, yeah. Are you prosecuting a war or just running a political campaign using big machines? Pretty obvious what's going on here. Pretty obvious that it's more of a concern of this White House, the politics of it, but the politics aren't working either. People know it's a joke. People know that it's a joke what we're doing, and or on more accurately, not doing. John McCain, speaking over the weekend, called for forward air controllers as well as special forces and more of those kind of raids that were so successful into Syria. Another former U.S. Air Force general agreed, saying, "We need to get somebody to find the targets and air power to blow them up, period." No, I agree with that. That's forward thinking. Find the enemy, identify it, destroy it. Find the enemy, identify it, destroy it, repeat. Pretty simple stuff here. I mean, it's not really exactly high science. It's prosecuting a war. And speaking of Hillary Clinton in her tangled mess, recently released emails detail then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. It detailed her interest in arming Libyan opposition groups using private security contractors before the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, though at the time the opposition was not formally recognized by the United States or United Nations, which prohibited arming without following strict guidelines and oversight. The issue remains so sensitive that the emails recently released by the State Department redacted a key line on the matter, but the unredacted portions released to the Congressional Benghazi Select Committee and first posted by the New York Times showed Clinton appearing to endorse the idea of using private contractors to her then Deputy Chief of Staff, Jake Sullivan. FYI, the idea of using private security experts to arm the opposition should be considered, she wrote. The opposition was known as the Transitional National Council, or TNC. Another email released by the State Department shows that 3 days earlier, Bill Clinton said he would not rule out arming the Libyan opposition. So there you have it, you know, and where's Bill's fingerprints? Well, all over it. Hillary? You know, maybe she was trying to do the right thing there. Hard to say. But as more of these emails roll out, we'll try to figure out more. It's now 14 after the hour. It's Thursday. It's Thursday on the Steve Gerber Show. We'll be right back after this.
The Steve Gerber Show. Get the news and information vital to your world.
I see the bad moon rising. I see trouble on the way.
18 after on this Thursday. Welcome back to it. It's the Steve Gerber Show. Appreciate your support. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966. In the wake of chronic wasting disease, or CWD, being confirmed in a wild deer here in Michigan, the Department of Natural Resources is moving quickly to implement an emergency plan it's had in place for many years but had hoped to never use. The emergency management plan dates back to 2002 and is aggressive. It will likely change the dynamics of the deer population in the state for generations to come. And that's no understatement, my friends. CWD is a neurological disease that is found in deer, elk, and moose. The disease creates small pinhole-like lesions in the brain that causes the animal to deteriorate both mentally and physically and is always fatal. Deer infected often display unusual behavior like no fear of humans and are often described as being zombie-like. They are also much more likely to be hit by cars. Michigan confirmed the disease in a deer killed earlier this year in Ingham County's Meridian Township just east of Lansing. Now, another possibly more controversial part of the emergency action plan will involve the use of federal sharpshooters from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife snipers, according to my sources, will use 223 caliber rifles outfitted with silencers to kill numerous deer without causing alarm in local neighborhoods. You heard me right. 223s. 223s with silencers. And it's the way it's done. They need to get in. They need to figure out what the infection rate is. And the only way to do that is to test deer. Well, they want to do that kind of quietly, so they'll slide into neighborhoods, often in the middle of the night as well, so they remain undetected. So there will be these U.S. Fish and Wildlife professional sharpshooters, and they'll kill a lot of deer, as many as is deemed necessary to collect enough samples so they can get enough data to test for chronic wasting disease. Now, if no more cases are found at the core area, which is really Ingham County more than anything else, then the plan may hold in place for the next 2 to 3 years. However, if more cases of CWD are confirmed, be prepared for wholesale elimination of the deer herd in the affected areas. I know they're looking to find a deer in the Weberville area that shows symptoms of CWD. I know they're looking at other animals in and around mid-Michigan that show symptoms of CWD. You see, the deer they found was 6 years old, a six-year-old doe, which means she's been through the breeding cycle at least five times, which means she's likely had offspring, which means she's also had a lot of contact with other deer is the point, which means chronic wasting disease. If there was only one case, I would be surprised. So if more cases of CWD are confirmed, be prepared for the wholesale slaughter of the deer herd. It's the way it's done if you want to contain the disease. In Wisconsin, for example, state wildlife officials there killed some 25,000 deer near Madison after an outbreak just a few years ago. Now, here in, and you got to keep this in mind, this could happen in your neighborhood. Unfortunately, it happened in mine. In fact, both pieces of property I own in Michigan that are my residence in a small hobby farm, both located in the affected areas. So deer hunting for me and my children, well, I don't know if there will be any in the next couple of years. This year it's going to be great. It's going to be gangbusters. Kill everything. Because local hunters are going to be asked to help, and the state's going to hand out unlimited antlerless tags, many at reduced prices. Many will be free of charge. Make no mistake, the deer population in and around Lansing is in the crosshairs and could be wiped out almost completely, if not altogether. Now, for those of you wondering if you can catch the disease, the answer is no, you cannot, at least for now. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta and epidemiologists at the Colorado Department of Public Health have studied CWD and found no link to any neurological diseases that affect humans. However, the Michigan DNR does include some of the following warnings on its website. Simple precautions advised include the following. Do not shoot, handle, or consume any animal that appears to be sick. Call the Michigan Department of Natural Resources if you see or kill an animal that appears to be sick. Wear rubber gloves when field dressing carcasses. Bone out the meat from your animal. Minimize the handling of brain and spinal tissue. Wash hands and your instruments thoroughly after field dressing is complete. Avoid, this next part's easy. Avoid consuming the brain, spinal cord, eyes, spleen, tonsils, and lymph nodes. I can do that. There's no issue there. Normal field dressing coupled with boning out a carcass will remove most, if not all, of these body parts. Cutting away all fatty tissue will remove remaining lymph nodes. Avoid consuming the meat from any animal that tests positive for the disease. and request that your animal is processed individually without meat from other animals being added to meat from your animal. I had the opportunity yesterday to speak to some deer processors around southern Michigan. They don't know what to do at this point. They know that it's going to damage their businesses, though, tremendously. They don't know what to do, whether to take in deer or not take in deer from these areas, whether they should trust the hunters to tell them the truth about where the deer came from. For another gentleman that runs the HOPE program, Tom Cullimore, who's been on this program many times, who collects venison and other meat to distribute to folks in need, he said it's going to be devastating to his operation. He'll need more beef, more chicken, more chances that way, because the venison's going to dry up on him. It's going to be devastating, he says. He feeds thousands of people a year. Other food banks around the state could also be in trouble. We'll talk more about this coming up here in a minute on the program. Straight ahead, Charlotte Hayes will be here, the director of cultural programs at the Independent Women's Forum. A teen genius solves the problem of college debt. We'll shift gears after the break.
Michigan's radio program of record is The Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
After the hour. Welcome back to it, my friends. It's The Steve Gruber Show on this Thursday. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-900-9966. 888-900-9966, the number to call. You know, we always want to make our kids' lives a little bit better. We work hard, we sacrifice, hoping that they have a better life than we did, and it's worked for several generations. Now people start to wonder, is it going to work this time around? Will our kids have it better than we did? Or will things start to go the other way? I mean, with the price of college, my God, it's staggering. And you've looked at it. The price of college is, you know, incredible. Here to talk about that and a teen genius that found a way maybe to solve the problem of college debt and so forth. Charlotte Hayes here, the Director of Cultural Programs at the Independent Women's Forum. Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I love to be on your show.
Love to have you back. You ladies, I like all of you. You're all different, and you're all very well educated, and you all have different things to talk about, and I do appreciate it. I think the audience does as well.
Well, thank you. Now I want to talk. This is a really important subject. This brilliant young teenager has single-handedly solved the college loan debt problem. It was a blindingly simple maneuver. It was this Tennessee kid, Ronald Nelson Jr., National Merit Scholar, star athlete, saxophone player, SAT high score, student body president, and guess how he solved the student loan problem? He was accepted by 8 Ivy League colleges and a bunch of other top-rated colleges, and he's going to the University of Alabama. Now, look, this is not to denigrate an Ivy League education. I believe in a great education. The one thing I would sacrifice for a child is an education. But look, we've reached the point where you can sacrifice and live on bread and water, and you still can't afford an education. So the Nelson family, they really did some soul searching on this, and young Ronald Nelson is going to Alabama. They're going to give him a good scholarship, and he's going to get out. He wants to be a doctor, unburdened by loan. Now, I was interested, Mary Catherine Hamm did a great item on this, and she saw some internet publication that was writing about how tragic it was that young Nelson couldn't go to an Ivy League school. And as Mary Catherine said, they treated it like a Shakespearean tragedy. No, it's not a Shakespearean tragedy. Look, it's this mindset that allows schools to let their tuitions go up and up and up out of the market. And the person who I think, the couple in America who I think are most guilty of promoting this outlook are Barack and Michelle Obama. And I recount in this little piece I wrote about going to hear Michelle Obama speak in Richmond when he was a candidate, first candidate. He was still just a senator. And she said, you know, she complained about their college debts. But then she said, Barack and I had world-class class education. Americans, and we wouldn't be here without them. And I thought, gee whiz, is the Obama promise so fragile that it couldn't have withstood, say, a state university?
Yeah, that's what comes to mind here. Yeah. You know, I look around here, and of course we've got Michigan State University. The University of Michigan, which is pretty well thought of for a state school, right? It's also expensive.
Look, they're great state schools.
Absolutely.
And Ronald Nelson is going to one. Bama, it's a good school. You can hear I'm from down there.
Yeah, in fact, I can hear that. Yeah, I didn't want to say. You know, I went to college for 2 years to learn to speak Southern. You know, that's part of my foreign languages was to speak Southern, which, you know, took a while, but I got it figured out.
Where'd you go?
I went to Montana State University. So I went to a state college out west. So, you know, the only college, by the way.
And apparently it wasn't very tragic, right?
It wasn't tragic. No, it wasn't. One of my brothers went to a private school. One of my brothers went to a couple of public universities, and we all turned out just fine and successful. You know, that's something else that comes to mind, though, that there's this whole idea that we're also shuffling our kids in. And I want you to think about this, Charlotte, because I've focused on this. We are shuffling kids down the same lane and all saying, hey, you got to go to college, you got to go to college, you got to go to college. And we're prepping them and we're sending out 10 billion kids to college to get their communications degree that isn't worth doodly squat, because 10,000 other kids in the same block have a communications degree and it doesn't mean a damn thing. And yet they're in debt and they can't get a job at McDonald's because we're forcing all these kids to conform. The problem with it is 99% of all student debt is held by the United States government now because the private lenders have been pushed out.
Going to back that debt up, people are going to assume it. Look, the president wants to either fix it so that the debt goes away after 20 years. That's not moral.
You have
Here's
a positive.
What you should learn in college. It's not moral to shirk your debts.
Well, I agree with that.
You can learn that at a state by the way.
You have a better look at the debt than I. You have a better opinion of the debt than I do. See, I think it's much more sinister than that. I think if you can put a whole generation of kids out on the street with the government hook in their wallet because they owe the government, because that's what we train them to do, march down here, little soldier, march down here, go to college, get $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in debt, and then you're on the hook. Then you're on the hook to the government,
right?
Not to the local bank, to the government. And then you owe the government. Well, we sent you to school. You owe us. That's
right. I think you're making a great point. And I also think it's a vicious circle. What makes tuition so high is the government keeps backing these loans. Colleges don't have to say, well, if we charge that much, people won't come. And that's why Ronald Nelson Jr. is a hero to me. He didn't go to a college he couldn't afford. And if a lot of people in this country did that, college tuition would come down. And you raise another thing. Look, I'm all for a liberal arts education, and even though I couldn't do it, I think you should take math, too. but we get these people with these sort of bogus degrees, women's studies. I mean, look, if you want to read Gloria Steinem, let's read her. But is this really something you want to major in?
No, and here's the thing. You know, you talk about failure in the math courses. That's okay. It's pretty clear there's not a single person in Washington, D.C. working for this White House that took a math course either.
So, well, yeah, they learned the art of borrowing.
Yeah, they did that, but paying back.
But repaying's not on the agenda.
Yeah, understanding how a credit card works, they don't seem to have that very well in tow either. You know, you have all these, I mean, let's be honest, they spend money that they don't have day after day, every single day, and they don't care. And you know what? It's not just Democrats. It's Republicans as well that are all just as damn guilty. And putting our kids and our generation, it's not just the debt for school they're handing to us. It's the debt overall for, who knows, a billion programs that went before that turned into dust, and yet we get to pay for things that just doesn't matter.
Well, you know, the other thing is I also noticed that a lot of people who have fancy educations from private colleges don't use basic grammar very well. They say things like, give it to Michelle and I. Should be me. I think college is giving lousy educations at really high prices.
You know, in many cases, that's true. So I'm glad this young man went to Alabama as opposed to
He's going to be a doctor. And listen, the fact that he's made this decision so well, he'll get out in time to be my geriatrics doctor, I hope. He sounds like a great young man. I want to go to him.
Well, there you go, Charlotte. And I'd like to have you back in the future to talk about what are the real solutions to staying out of debt, because you can't you can't pay tuition on what you make out there, you know, slinging burgers these days. It's almost impossible. But how do we get there? I don't know. We'll talk about it the next time you come on through.
Charlotte, thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, my dear. Thank you so much. Charlotte Hayes, the Director of Cultural Programs at the Independent Women's Forum here on the Steve Gruber Show on a Thursday morning. Always, always an interesting conversation. Well, still to come today, we're going to talk about the scenario of thousands of illegal aliens coming over the southern border. You know, and we have this idea that it's just a bunch of young kids from Guatemala and El Salvador. But why wouldn't it be terrorists from the Middle East coming over the border as well? We'll talk about that. And State Senator Jeff Hansen will be here to talk about a tentative $55 billion plan for roads. All straight ahead this day on The Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. Jump starting your day with the news that matters.
Try to see things my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, on the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone.
45 after the hour. 45 after the hour here on The Steve Gruber Show. Like I said, coming up today, we're going to talk more about the chronic wasting disease with Russ Mason and get an idea of what it's going to mean to the heritage and to money. It's going to be a big money problem. I mean, you can do the math pretty easily. You can do the math pretty easily if, say, if licenses have gone up, if the average person spends $50 getting a small game license and a deer license and maybe a fishing license, so on and so forth, spends $50-$60 and, you know, 20,000 people don't buy licenses. Well, that's $1 million quickly. And the amount of money involved in hunting and, well, just in hunting in Michigan is a $2.5 billion proposition. About a $2.5 billion annual proposition, the hunting industry in Michigan. And of course, make no mistake, the white-tailed deer is it's the cash cow. It's the biggest game animal in the world when it comes to spending money. It has no rival. It has no rival whatsoever. So, you know, the effects here in Michigan could be, well, it could be devastating. We have to watch and see here. But I'm telling you, one more positive diagnosis of CWD, and things just go off the rail for a while. Yeah, because who's going to want to drive here and come and hunt in Michigan and spend money and so on and so forth if, you know, if there's nothing to do here, why would you do that? Mm-hmm. So there you have it. We're also going to talk about illegal immigration here in a moment. The Washington Post leading today with a drop in illegal immigration on their front page. Meanwhile, residents in an Arizona border town say it's like a war zone all the time. We have that coming up in just a moment. This is an interesting story, though, that I have here. Aaron Corr thought he had seen enough of Iraq during a U.S. Army tour that ended back in 2010. But when he saw American journalist James Foley being murdered by an ISIS executioner, getting his head cut off by a pocket knife, it prompted him to pack his bags in Tennessee and head back. But this time he is an unpaid volunteer in the service. Of the Kurdish Peshmerga. The 27-year-old Chattanooga. See, you hear about the people running off to join ISIS. Well, guess what? There are motorcycle gangs from Europe and soldiers from America, professional soldiers, going to fight on the other side. Because whether or not this country will do the right thing, we have people that will. And I think you'll start to hear more about this as the days go on. The 27-year-old Chattanooga resident and former Army National Guard specialist took a moment to speak to Fox News at a Kurdish base near Kirkuk, where he has served since last fall, taking part in numerous firefights with ISIS as the Kurds battle to stop the terrorist army's caliphate from encroaching on its territory in the nation's north. You know, and this brings to mind something that you should be perfectly aware of. Iraq, the nation of Iraq, no longer exists, and it never will exist again in the form that it was. That I can assure you. Because the Kurds are never going to rejoin the nation of Iraq, not voluntarily, and the Shiites and the Sunnis, obviously separated by their beliefs, and the Kurds will never join back in. It's a little aside for you, so just so you understand the lay of the land. Whatever ISIS has done, I can guarantee you this, they have broken Iraq into rump states, and it'll stay that way. Rump states being what's left over when a nation crumbles. When I heard they had their first American victim, I had to come back. Kaur said, referring to Foley, who was beheaded in that grisly video posted online by ISIS last August. I just had to, he said. An American flag patch sits on Kaur's shoulder, just above one bearing both the American and Kurdish flag, representing his status as a volunteer with the Kurdish Peshmerga. Kaur isn't alone, by the way. At least two other Americans who did not give their last names sat nearby. Taylor, a 23-year-old veteran from Texas, and Kurt, a 25-year-old U.S. Marine from Washington State, said they were also drawn to the region by a need to stand up to the brutality and the barbarism of the Islamic State. I decided I wanted to make a difference and fight Daesh, which is Arabic for ISIS, by the way, Daesh, and support the Kurdistan people in their struggle. So I bought a ticket, Kurt said. Taylor, a former Army soldier, said he was on his way back home working at minimum wage when he decided the skills he acquired in the U.S. military could best be put to use fighting with the only army that seemed to be standing up to ISIS. By the way, the United States Department, U.S. State Department, that is, does not support or encourage Americans traveling to Iraq to volunteer, but has not stopped many from doing so. Since the Syrian-based Islamic State's invasion of Iraq in June of 2014, the Peshmerga have so far been successful in stopping their advances into Kurdish territory, yet they are far from defeating the Islamic State. The Islamic State fighters, who include men tested on the battlefields of Syria as well as many former members of the Iraqi army, are a formidable foe. They're not the JV squad, exactly. They are no joke, said Kurt. They are disciplined, highly effective fighters. If we are not careful, they will win. While the help of Western volunteers is welcomed by the Kurds, many more Westerners have chosen to fight with ISIS, an irony not lost on Kurdish Brigadier General Aris Kadir of the 9th Brigade. Most of the people from your countries who have come to volunteer with the Peshmerga have come to fight the people from your countries who have joined ISIS. That's true, but just about all of the folks that joined ISIS don't have that experience as a U.S. Marine or a specialist in the United States military of any sort. I put my money on the Marines. Always. Always. It is 51 after the hour on this Thursday. I told you it'd be an interesting story. It's the Steve Gruber Show. If you'd like to get involved, 888-900-9966. We'll be right back.
Is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop.
Yeah,
stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and wrong. Here is Steve Gruber.
It is 6 minutes after the hour on this Thursday. Thank you for stopping in. Appreciate your support. Heavy rains in Texas still causing big problems there. And keep an eye on that. We're also going to keep an eye on the issue with chronic wasting disease here in Michigan. We'll be getting to that in just a moment as we work our way through, that issue. We have a lot more information on that coming forward from Russ Mason from the DNR. Talk about that. And lawmakers here have approved a $55 billion plan for the state budget. We'll talk about that coming up. $55 billion plan. And State Senator Jeff Hansen will be here to talk about how that bears out on roads and schools and everything else. Take a look at that. But first, this hour, we're going to talk about the very real possibility. What if the Republicans don't decide? What if the Republicans cannot decide who should be their candidate for president of the United States? It's been a long time since it went down to multiple ballots at a convention, but that could certainly happen this time around. Many times when it happened, the Republicans would win the presidency anyway. But on the Democratic side, in the run-up to the 1988 Democratic caucus, the party failed to coalesce around a candidate. Colorado Senator Gary Hart had led in the polls, but an extramarital affair knocked him out of contention. Today, it'd probably get him nominated on the first go-round. The governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, though he was a favorite of the party, declined to run, and that left the party elites with a lackluster field, to say the least, when they failed to come to a consensus before Iowa. The party eventually got behind Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, but that was only after he won a number of primaries, and that, as you may remember, turned out to be a complete disaster. It's important because the electorate shaped the party's choices. If the party elites had wanted support to support another candidate, say back then Illinois Senator Paul Simon, they would have had a tough time promoting their candidate over Dukakis, Dick Gephardt, or somebody else from that era. As you remember, the Democrats were in disarray in 2004 as well. Even though the Democratic establishment believed Vermont Governor Howard Dean, the frontrunner for a large period of time leading up to Iowa, was too politically liberal and personally aggressive to win the general election, it was unable to unite behind a more mainstream candidate before Iowa. Dean, obviously, he faltered. And John Kerry gained momentum. Similar to 1988. The most recent party failure for the Republicans, 2008, when John McCain was the nominee. And what a disaster that was. You know, McCain, a self-described maverick, which is a joke in itself, made enemies within the party by breaking from conservative orthodox thinking on campaign finance reform, immigration, and other issues. So in 2016, right now, how many candidates we have announced or likely? I think we have like 16 or 18 on the board. There are like 16 or 18 Republicans on the board this time around, and Ohio Governor John Kasich making it clear yesterday he intends to run. He's actively engaging reactions to a possible campaign for president in 2016. He's now moving rapidly to assemble the staff and financial resources necessary to put a bid together and is looking to declare his candidacy sometime after June the 30th. He's coming late, but he's going to bring the heat. I've been telling you, John Kasich is going to be a formidable candidate for a long time. He's building his machine right now. The two-term governor and former House member, two-term governor of Ohio, let me be clear, and former House member running through a checklist before he will formally enter the race, but strategists close to him say, there is no doubt he will soon join the crowded field for those vying to be the GOP nominee. And his calling cards will include fiscal conservatism, both as House Budget Committee Chair and as a governor of a big and politically important state. He has national security credentials as the former member of the House Armed Services Committee and a faith-based focus on programs and policies to help those most in need that advisors think could set him apart from his competitors. I'm not worried about standing out, Kasich said in a recent interview. What I have over the rest of the field is experience that no one else has, national security, legislative, and executive. And he's right. And I've said this, one of the things I say often to people around me, and they will attest to this, is there is no substitute for, thank you, honey, experience. See, I told you people that are around me hear this all the time. There is no substitute for experience. And we've seen this over the last 7 years as the current occupant of the White House has displayed time and again his blatant lack of experience. When he runs, like I said, Kasich will be with like 16 or 18 other candidates in this race. But he is backed in New Hampshire by an extremely important person. John Sununu, former senator of that state and governor. And multimillionaire John Sununu in New Hampshire. He is Kasich's man there. And that is important. Of all the people in the race, or could be in the race, John Sununu, who has great influence in the state of New Hampshire, which obviously you know is key early on, and New Hampshire's key at the end of the race for its 4 electoral votes, it's key and sometimes goes Republican over the rest of the region. These are all key things. But what if it comes down to several ballots at the convention? Oh, you can imagine the glee of the left-wing media. Oh, they'll love it. They'll call it a Republican bloodbath, and they'll call it infighting and backstabbing and blah, 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 blah. They'll try to make it look awful. By comparison, it'll look like a pillow fight compared to what the Clintons do to people, but hey, or what Obama did to Clinton. It looked like a pillow fight compared to that, but hey, the media will paint it quite a bit differently, I can assure you of that. At the end of the day, it'll be politics, and I think it's a good thing for this country to have as many Republicans running as possible and as many Democrats running as possible, so you have a clear choice. Right now, there are only 2 Democrats, and the media is completely ignoring Bernie Sanders on the left, which is unfortunate. You know, he speaks for a lot of progressives in this country. I see it online all the time. A lot of people support Bernie Sanders and his beliefs that everything should be free and you should pay for it, however that works. And he should be out there talking about it. It's 14 after the hour on this Thursday morning. I'm Steve Gruber. This is The Steve Gruber Show.
Michigan's radio program of record is The Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
Sheepdog, standing in the rain.
18.
Bullfrog,
18 after the hour.
Doing it again.
Thursday morning, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-900-9966, 888-900-9966. You know, with so many things going on, you lose track of big, important stories, and I've said this before, but you know, with so many things going on, so many different things could be our main talking point, our main conversation of the day. So many different things could take up that position any given day here. So like the illegal alien invasion of the southern border, you know, we talk about it a lot, you know, a year ago. And then other things drive it from the front page. Problems with ISIS or whatever else is going on drives it from the front page. Clinton cash and Hillary Clinton scandals. And while we're not paying attention to the southern border, it's possible that a terrorist could slide in and bring, you know, their ideology and their weapons with them. Dan Perkins with us again this morning. Dan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me on again.
Always appreciate it. You're the author of the Brotherhood of the Red Nile trilogy. And this is a real problem. And first of all, it's a problem that we have this flood of illegals coming over the border. It's devastating financially. There's no security at all. But then if you put the idea that maybe somebody from ISIS or some other group could infiltrate our country, which clearly I think they obviously could, Dan, it's a concern.
Well, not only they can, they've indicated this past weekend in a release that was covered by Newsmax TV that not only do they have the resources, meaning the money to go buy bombs, they believe they'll bring them in through the southern border from Mexico and will probably, this is their words, not mine, detonate them sometime next year.
So, wait a minute.
They're telling the world and they're telling America, we've got the money to buy the bombs. We can get it from Pakistan. They didn't say that they could also get it from Russia, but I think that's true. They can't get it from Russia. And they're coming here within a year. And so they're giving us the signals of what's going to happen. And the question really becomes, one, do we believe them? And if we do, what are we going to do about it? And
well, let's start with that.
What risks are we taking?
Let's start with that, Dan. Do we believe them? I mean, if this were the case, let me play devil's advocate here. If this were the case that they could get their hands on a suitcase nuke or something like that, wouldn't they have already touched it off in Israel or the Middle East or somewhere else? I mean, really, would they wait to try to get it here? I think they would demonstrate their ability to do that in London or Madrid or the Middle East or somewhere. So, first of all, do you believe it?
Well, I believed it at the time I wrote the first book, which talks about this very scenario. Yes, I do believe it. Do I believe that it's going to happen in the United States? If you can step back and just ask yourself, what one nation could ISIL attack that could say the message to the rest of the world, we are for real?
That's a fair point you make.
It's not England. It ain't France. It ain't Germany.
No, I get it. It's a fair point you make.
Yeah, it's
us. But the question is, do we really believe that could be pulled off? I mean, think about the logistics, the planning, the secrecy that would have to be involved with such a thing. And I don't know the answer. I don't know what I believe. Do I believe it's possible? I believe it's possible. I don't know if I would say that I believe it's likely.
Well, they're saying it's likely. These people are masters of using social media and using reporters to their advantage. That report that they made last week is, that's pretty specific. We know where we can get the bombs. We've got the money. We've got the billions of dollars to buy them. And we know where the best way to bring them in. Now, you can question whether they can get a hold of the bomb. I think it's hard to question that they don't have the money, because I think even our own government admits that they have billions of dollars because of the oil fields and other things that they took over one bank and took over $500 million in deposits in cash in the bank. So I don't dispute the money situation. Is there a possibility that there's enough money in the world to buy one or two devices on the open market? That's a real degree of probability. Can it come through the United States or through into the United States from the southern border? I could create a scenario that says it's not going to be as difficult as you can imagine. In fact, think about this for a second. Pick any spot on the border, the southern border with Mexico, and let's say El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
So you start off by creating a surge, much like Petraeus did in Iraq. Start a surge. You bring a huge number of people to crush the border, to overpower, in essence, the ability of Homeland Security and Border Patrol to protect,
deal with
that
it, yeah.
Yeah. And then they do it again.
Let me ask you this, though, Dan.
Yep.
What if we're all looking at the southern border and they sneak it in our back door in Michigan or Minnesota?
I wrote that. I wrote that very scenario that it comes through Whitefish, Montana.
There you go.
Through a border crossing. So, yes, they could bring it into Canada. They can bring it into Mexico, just as a point of reference. Why Mexico? Through the Gulf of Mexico first, and then into Mexico. There are 8,000 abandoned oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico.
Well, the other reason is, Dan, because the Mexicans, is by and large, they're all corrupt, and they all take payments and bribes and so forth. I got to run, Dan. And for anybody that doesn't know Mexico, it's a very corrupt place. It's probably easier to buy people off in Mexico. Although, north of the border, I don't know. 25 after, Dan, I greatly appreciate your time. Dan Perkins, everybody, the author of the Red Nile Trilogy, the Brotherhood of the Red Nile Trilogy. Find it online. Dan Perkins, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Always. 25 after the hour on a Thursday. Always something to think about here. Always something to think about. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-900-9966. It's the Steve Gruber Show on a Thursday. We'll be right back.
This is the Steve Gruber Show, bringing you the news and newsmakers that affect you most.
Three after the hour. If you're going for a ride and you're going to be heading in and out of Lansing at all or going north or south, ride on into Ryan's Roadhouse, about 20 minutes north of Lansing in St. John's, Michigan. Ryan's Roadhouse, a true roadhouse. And by the way, if you're looking for a chance to take your friends at the office out for, you know, some fun, he's offering a free office party, Ryan is, a couple times a month. All you have to do is register and win. You go to Ryan's Roadhouse on Facebook. Pretty simple stuff here. Ryan's Roadhouse on Facebook. Sign up, and you and your friends could be riding out to enjoy a Friday night office party, courtesy of my friends at Ryan's Roadhouse. Go check that out. You know, I have a brand new General Motors vehicle, and I was astonished. I really was. When we bought this vehicle in November, I guess. At the amount of electronics and information and everything that's going on with this vehicle, it's wired. Millions of cars now wired to the internet directly. Millions of cars and small and light trucks wired to the internet, so you have, you know, navigation services and music services and anything you want. In our case, we roll down the road with our laptops open, not the driver, but the passenger rolls down the road with the laptop open, and we get a lot of work done going down the road, and that's just the beginning, because every year there's more and more. Joining me next is Rich Martinek, the Senior Manager of Brand and Consumer Insights of General Motors. Rich, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Glad to have you. And like I said, my 2015 Sierra is decked out with a lot of electronics and different things that I was shocked at everything that it does. I hadn't bought a new vehicle in a few years, and there it is. It pretty much does everything and keeps me connected to the world, and it's great. But the technology continues to evolve, and you've made some announcements so far this week in California. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, there's a couple things. I mean, as you were mentioning before, there's a lot of technology that we're putting in our vehicles today, not just us, but many of the competitors. It's important because, people have a very connected life outside their vehicle, and they want to bring that into their vehicle. And if you think about technology, the best technology are the ones that really fill a consumer need, as well as make people's lives better. And, you know, driving around, and you're talking about driving around in your new Sierra, when you drive around in that, you probably see people that don't really do a good job of how they use their smartphone in their vehicle. We've got a lot of people out there that just don't practice, safe driving tactics, I would say. We've got a better way, and that's really the thing that we're announcing, or we announced yesterday, was a better way to do that in the vehicle. So for 2016, Chevrolet is going to offer both Apple CarPlay, and Android Auto compatibility across the widest range of models in the industry and in the world. So that's kind of the big news that we've come out with in the last day or two.
So say that again, just so we understand exactly what is going on exactly that you have that nobody else has.
Well, and so here's the thing. There's like 2.3 billion smartphones in the world, right?
Wow.
I mean, everybody uses their smartphone in their daily lives. What they want is a simple and a smart way to bring that into their vehicle and use it in a way, that makes sense. So what you do is really there's working with Apple and with Google, specifically on Android Auto. What we've done is we've built the capability into 2016 vehicles that are going to start to roll out this summer, where you can bring your smartphone in, okay? And again, it's a Apple iPhone,
right.
Or a an Android phone that runs Android Lollipop 5.0.
I understand.
And you bring those into the vehicle, you can connect them via the USB cord. And when you do that, what happens is the screen functionality and the phone functionality goes up onto the screen in the vehicle. And then what you can do is you can manage all the stuff. Instead of having to look down to your phone, you can put it away in some kind of storage unit, and you can use all the stuff right on the screen.
How nice.
And so
that
way you can get to navigation. You can get to your music apps and different things that they've actually customized that experience, because it's an in-vehicle experience. Again, it's not something you would use like you use your smartphone today, but something that's very much customized for the in-vehicle driving experience.
So let me get this straight, Rich. I have to go buy another new vehicle? I'm just pulling your leg.
That we've just started to roll out.
We're going to start
to put it on vehicles this summer. So no, the current 15 that you have is not going to have that.
Yeah, I'm not happy.
You know, that's
that
not something we've had to actually make some updates to the hardware in the vehicle.
I understand
that as we start to build the 16 model year vehicles, we're going to be putting this in as we go forward.
I know. I'm just giving you a hard time. Rich Martinek on the phone here, the senior manager of brand and consumer insights of GM. Now, one of the things, Rich, that people are going to ask, because I'm going to ask, is, okay, tell me about security, because one of the things that everybody's concerned about now is, you know, identity theft and getting their computers hacked and other issues and other problems. How are you going to make sure that, you know, extending their iPhone, which you're an iPhone owner, aren't you, Rich?
Actually, I am an iPhone owner, yes.
Yeah, I can tell because you stumbled over the Android part of it, so you know the iPhone's better. But the point being is, see, I caught you. You're an Apple man, and so am I. Don't worry, I'm an iPhone guy. But
you did
security,
get me on that one.
Yeah, I got you. But the iPhone thing, like I have the iPhone 6 Plus, so I'm half blind, so I can see it at my older age. But what about security? How are people going to be safe in their technology and say, okay, I feel good about this?
Yeah. Well, with this, really what's happening is there's no additional security that's required with when you connect into this. You're literally taking the USB cord, you're connecting it into the vehicle, and when it goes into that, it's really going up to the screen, where the functionality that's happening on the phone is controllable through the screen. So there's no additional security protocols that have to go on something like that. It's literally using the function of the phone.
So it's basically... So
it's no different than had I not connected it into my car, and I drove with it, and
I got you.
Every once in a while, which we would never recommend, looked over at my phone while I'm driving.
Right.
Now what we've done is we've taken that and literally just taken the screen, because now what happens is the phone locks out, and the functionality goes up on the screen in the car on the 7 or 8 inch screen that you have in the Chevrolet. And then you can use the buttons. But there's no additional things. It'd be just the same as if I was driving along using my phone disconnected from the car from that standpoint.
So in effect, your vehicle becomes a really nice monitor, if you will, you know, with wheels and an engine and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool.
I'd say a touch monitor to be different, right?
Ooh,
it's not just where we're doing screen scraping, right, which you've probably heard that term before. It's not where we're taking it. All we're doing is putting a broadcast. It's not that the screen is completely a dumb screen where it's not doing anything other than showing you a picture. It's actually where you can interact with the functionality, just like you interact with the radio today, right?
Sure. Yeah,
people
absolutely.
Are used to that. They're used to taking the splits, you know, to making sure that they keep their focus on the road and what they're doing, and then, you know, looking over for a half second to change the radio station. It's the same thing here as what they're already doing in their vehicles today. Mm-hmm. So that way, it's a much more appropriate way to use the functionality that your phone brings into the vehicle.
More heads-up display and more, you know, eyes on the road, safety first type attitude, which I like, because let's be honest, a lot of people get distracted. People get distracted by the radio as well, but let's be honest, texting and driving is still a dangerous thing out there. If you can keep people's eyes up towards the road, it's a better place to be. It just keeps evolving, Rich, and it's better all the time, and I'm always impressed and love the vehicles that I've seen rolled out from GM in the last few months as well. What do you have for us? I'll give you 20 seconds for the last word.
We're pretty excited about this. We think this is a huge piece of technology you're bringing in the vehicle. As I mentioned up front, it's something when you've got everybody pretty much using smartphones today, it makes a big difference as they bring this into their vehicle. And it's going to make people do the right things in a better way on the road.
And when everybody's synced up anyway between their laptop, their phone, and now their car, just makes it easier and smoother too. Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
There you have it. Rich Martinek, the Senior Manager, Brand and Consumer Insights of General Motors. The computers are taking over the world, make no mistake. 41 after the hour.
The Steve Gruber Show. Jump starting your day with the news that matters.
All righty, welcome back to the program. It is 45 after the hour. I don't know how you would describe this week for the Department of Natural Resources here in Michigan or for people that are involved in hunting in this state. Disappointing doesn't begin to cover it. Devastating, maybe. Devastating, maybe, as we have learned that chronic wasting disease has been confirmed in a wild deer in southern lower Michigan, which is, I don't know, for some it's nothing short of tragic, I'll be honest with you. And for me, I don't know how I drew the short stick, but somehow my small farm is right in the center of the core area of concern, so therefore the deer population in my area will probably be altered for generations to come. Here to talk a bit more about it, Chief Russ Mason with the DNR's Wildlife Division. Russ, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, all right, let's. I mean, we've talked in over the last day or two about the disease, what it does, how it decimates the deer, and that it's spread by contact and so forth in the core area. But let's talk a little bit bigger picture, if we could, Russ, because, you know, Michigan has, 700,000 people that are involved with the firearm deer season, upwards of 300,000 involved in bow hunting. It's, I think, the third biggest state in America for selling licenses, behind only Texas and Pennsylvania. It's a big deal here, a $2.5 billion industry. What about the financial impact? What about the heritage of hunting in Michigan?
This is a very big deal for us. You know, at present, we're talking about three counties in central lower Michigan: Ingham, Clinton, and Shiawassee. And the aggressive steps that we're taking, we intend, if possible, to hold the disease into those counties. And the reason that's so important is if CWD becomes established, it will inevitably spread across all of lower Michigan. The models out there suggest as much as a 50% decline in deer. And more importantly than that, most of that decline is focused in older age classes, which means that folks that are interested in quality deer management, for example, and having older bucks aren't going to see them. And as you mentioned, you know, hunting is a big deal to the state. Hunting and fishing provide $4.7 billion annually to the economy. Tourism alone is $22 billion to Michigan's economy. So deer hunting is a big deal to this state, not just to the Department of Natural Resources, but to all those local businesses. And I've had farmers talk to me about the difference between making a profit in a year and not is their hunting lease. And that's right here in central Michigan. So yeah, we are very, very concerned.
Yeah, and I took the time last night to reach out to a gentleman in Shiawassee County who is my deer processor and said, hey, and he said, he goes, it's going to devastate my business. Because I'm asking him, are you going to take these deer or not take them? And he doesn't know, because even though the fact that, you know, it's not contagious to humans, you recommend, the DNR does, that these deer be processed separately from other deer. Well, that creates a problem for him. Plus the idea from some that they don't want their deer commingled with the deer that comes from the core area where my farm sits, unfortunately, again. So it creates problems for him. For another gentleman who is involved with the HOPE program that provides meals to people in need. He says he's going to take a hit because deer that have been donated in years past, he expects that to decline dramatically too. So this, I mean, it's already creating big problems, Russ.
It's a big deal for us, and perhaps the most vexing part of the whole deal is that CWD is more like a biohazard than it is a disease. It's a disease that's basically mediated by a corrupted protein. And that protein, you can't kill it with heat, you can't kill it with cold, you can't kill it with bleach, you can't kill it with anything. And when it gets into the soil, actually it becomes more infectious than when it was on an animal. So it's a disease that can be passed from one animal to another. It's a disease that can get into the soil and stay there literally indefinitely. Luckily, it doesn't move with water. But the point is, once you've got CWD established, essentially you have a contaminated area. So you could even clean all the deer out of that area. New deer will come in, and they will become infected because of contact with that substrate or because the prions are moving into plants that they forage on. This is a very big deal for the state of Michigan and for the other 23 states in the nation and two Canadian provinces where this disease is present.
So let me ask you, Russ, the sobering question is this. This deer is a six-year-old doe. She's been through five breeding cycles. She's found in the heart of Lower Michigan, Meridian Township in Ingham County. How did she get here? How did she get the disease? And how many deer did she come in contact with over her six-year lifetime of living and breathing in that area?
Well, there's a lot of unknowns here. First off, this disease can express itself very rapidly, and in just a couple of months, or sometimes it takes several years. So this deer could have been infected recently or could have been infected several years ago. Chances are there's maybe another deer or two. And what we're hoping is that for whatever reason, this is a very local infection. And there are a lot of ways this could happen. Most of them involve gasoline, frankly. It could have been somebody transported live deer, somebody transported carcasses from another state. It could have been any number of things along those lines. You know, every year in the fall, the Department of Natural Resources asks hunters not to bring in whole carcasses from CWD hot zones in Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and so forth. And every year, guys do, and we know they do. We're not sure how it got here, but the one thing we are certain of is that it did not spontaneously generate on the landscape. This isn't a disease that just appears out of the ether, drops from the sky. It got here one way or another with contaminated material, most likely having to do with the cervid, meaning a mule deer, a whitetail, a moose, or an elk.
Brought in from somewhere else. It's not an airborne pathogen is what you're saying here. So, okay, we don't have much time left. We're going to be talking about this a lot in the days and weeks and, unfortunately, years to come, Russ. Give me one bit of advice here in the last 20 seconds for people that are concerned. What's the number one thing that they can do? 20 seconds, last word.
Last thing they can do is continue to hunt in this area. We need as many samples as we can get. CWD doesn't affect people, and most of the deer that will be harvested in these three counties this year, probably nearly all of them, maybe all of them, won't have CWD.
Well, hopefully none of them will have CWD if we're really lucky, Russ, but I'm not sure any of us believe that's going to be the truth. Russ Mason, thank you very much. There you have it, Chief Russ Mason of the DNR Wildlife Division here on the Steve Gruber Show. Pay attention to the deer. Pay attention to what you're seeing. It'll wipe out the entire herd just like he explained. It's 52 after the hour.
This is Common Sense Radio. Straightforward and no excuses.
All right. Come on now.
This is the Steve Gruber Show.
Call me crazy.
Ooh, yeah.
What I said was perfectly right and spot on accurate.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it all.
Stop. Stop. I mean, you're way off script.
Got it in me. Gonna quit until it all comes out.
Hey, boy.
Yeah, you know, it's not cynical, it's common sense.
Pay attention to me when I'm talking to you.
I'm gonna rock the nation. Rock the nation.
Genuine, accountable, and raw. Here is Steve Gruber.
6 minutes after the hour on this Thursday morning. Welcome back to it. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, 888-900-9966. Pay attention to the next conversation because you might have some comments and some thoughts on this. But state lawmakers this week are accelerating efforts to finish the state budget and gave initial approval to the $55 billion plan, give or take a couple of nickels, but right around $55 billion. More money for roads, a funding boost, modest as it may be, to universities, community colleges, and more. Joining us on the line to talk more about it, State Senator Jeff Hansen. Good morning, sir.
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Oh, what a beautiful day.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, tell me about this. How are we doing on the budget? How are we progressing?
Hey, we're doing really well. We've got all but, I believe, one budget that's through the conference committee, which is, of course, my second budget that I have, which is school aid. We're hoping to get that done the first of the week. I think Tuesday we're going to get that out of conference committee, and then next week I think we're going to vote out the budgets, and we'll be done with them for a while.
So obviously this the voters of the state of Michigan historically rejected proposal one back on May the 5th. It didn't even muster 20% support statewide. Some places, some counties rejected it better than 90%. Where are we in trying to find a solution to bring some repairs to the infrastructure to upgrade our road system? Because everybody agrees it needs to be done to attract businesses and tourists. And heck, just for those of us that drive on these roads every day, where are we in that regard?
Well, right now what we're looking at is we put $400 million of general fund dollars into the transportation budget. Of that, $260 million will go through Act 51 to go out. It's 39% to the MDOT, 39% to our county roads, and then 22% towards cities, villages, and townships. So the $260 million was added on this year as a one-time funding again.
So what does that mean? I mean, we've talked about a lot of things. The film credit, for one thing, $50 million. People are saying that needed to be eliminated. MEDC in the target for some people, Pure Michigan, a place where people thought they could potentially change the way that we fund these things. What are some of the places where money has been moved around? Because what I think that the message we got, Senator, on May the 5th, the message that came out from the voters was, you know, find a way to do it without raising our taxes and without sticking it to us too badly, at least. And are we accomplishing that?
Well, I got to disagree with the way that you look at it, but I think that what they said is they didn't like what they saw. There was a lot of confusion with it. I think people understand that we've got a problem with our roads, and they are willing to pay for it. But, you know, but first we have to go and see what we've got in our budget. We have to dig in there. We have to, you know, first reuse, and then we have to make sure that we're going through everything before we go and ask for more money. And, you know, that's what we're going through right now. We've dug into all of the departments to be able to pull back money to be able to put into the roads. This year we had a little extra money at the end of the year when we had the revenue estimating conference. There was more money than we thought we were going to have. So we're able to put it into the roads, which is a great thing. We need to get some orange barrels out there and get our roads fixed.
Okay, Senator. You think I'm wrong about what people said on May the 5th. It didn't even generate 20% support statewide. I don't think people are rushing to say, hey, I'm willing to pay more taxes and pay higher fees. I guess I don't see that, sir. And to be kind, you know, I drive around this state and I see brand new rest areas being built that cost millions of dollars. I see a sign being put up at every intersection in the state saying the road coming up is such and such. I guess we were so unable to find the right road to turn on, we had to go around the state and spend probably millions of dollars there as well. One makes me wonder if our priorities are accurate when it comes to the road situation.
Well, I absolutely agree with you on some of those. You know, I look at, you know, you talk about the rest areas, and that's one of the things that I've had discussions with the director about. It's like, well, why do we need to replace a 20-year-old rest area? It's not like people are living there. You know, they go in, do their business, and then they leave.
No, but if we keep taxing people, they'll be living there. Anyhow, go on.
Yeah.
I know. Just saying.
Yeah, whatever. But I think we need to, you're right, the priorities, we have to make sure that we're putting money into the roads. And the dollars we're going to be putting in this year will be going into accelerating our five-year plan that they already have in place, so we make sure that we get the roads done that we need to get done.
So at least we're heading in part in the right direction. You know, because people in the state do look around, and here's the one thing that really, and it didn't come from you, obviously, but things that were said leading up to May 5th that, you know, Michigan taxpayers weren't paying their fair share towards roads. First of all, I find that term overused, but, you know, I look around to the states like Indiana and Ohio and Wisconsin. Listen, guys, we were in a recession here in Michigan for 10 years longer than everybody else. We were pretty well pinched, as you know, as we all know. And to basically tell Michigan taxpayers, well, you weren't paying your fair share, you need to pay more towards roads. It's like, wow. The gall of some people. I'm obviously that didn't come from your office, and I'm not saying it came from you at all. But I'm just saying the audacity of some is incredible.
It's not even saying that. It's saying, you know, what's it going to cost to keep our roads in the shape they should be in? Number one, and if you use them, you should be paying for it. It should be a user fee to pay for the roads.
What about the idea in Oregon where they're putting a little monitor in cars and however many miles you run is what you pay for? I mean,
I really don't want the government putting any type of monitor in my car.
I appreciate you saying that. I was just checking because I would appreciate it that they don't have. I mean, I think they have enough controls on us as it is. But
No, I really don't think that. Personally, I wouldn't look at that at all because I think that is just a little bit of overreach.
I would say, yeah, but I appreciate that. So give me an idea in the last few seconds here. When do you think this budget will go through? When do you think it might be done so you guys can call it good?
Well, the budget should be done next week. Everything should go through next week. But then we're going to be busy. We've got a lot of caucuses scheduled because we're going to be digging into this road funding thing, taking a deep dive and going at it again. I've been there 10 years. We've been working on it. And it's not an easy thing to work to find the correct answer to, and that's why it hasn't been done yet.
All right. Senator Jeff Hansen, thank you so much for stopping in today and sharing your thoughts.
I appreciate it, and I'll keep listening to you in the morning when I go to work.
There you go. State Senator Jeff Hansen, a Republican. Thank you, sir. Greatly appreciate it. Okay. Real quickly to the phone lines, we can get two in quick. Mike, you got about 20 seconds. Mike in East Lansing, what's on your mind?
You know what? they probably need to get more snowplows and shovels to deal with the stuff that this guy was shoveling. They have no money at the state until they take it from us. They take $55 billion out of our pockets to fund the government. It's not their money. It's our money. They have to be better stewards of it, and they could start by perhaps cutting Detroit, cutting welfare, and do something that's going to be more productive to benefit the state, like fixing the roads. Take 10% out of Detroit's budget that we send to them. We don't need to be raising money for college education. Let the colleges figure out how to work within their budgets. It's always easy. Take it from the taxpayers and distribute it out, sick, lame, and lazy, to the colleges and for the benefit of the politicians.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for checking in. It's the Steve Gruber Show.
Michigan's radio program of record is the Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
Every now and then there are people that capture my attention because they're different. They're outspoken and they're well-spoken and they get my attention. That describes my next guest to a T, an American lawyer, writer, radio and television personality, and host of his own program called The Larry Elder Show, and he's gotten up early from California to touch base with us. Larry Elder, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, let's talk. I mean, I want to introduce you a little bit to the folks that maybe aren't familiar with you. I've followed you on Twitter and Facebook and other places and listened to some of your podcasts and so forth, and I find your take different and interesting, which is why you're here. But what I find most fascinating is the fact that, okay, you're a black man. You're living in California in the epicenter of all things liberal, I think. You're right there in Hollywood, basically. And I just wonder, you know, how do you fit in a cocktail party, you know, because... I mean, let's be honest, black conservatives or libertarians in your case, you know, you don't get treated particularly well in the press and elsewhere. So how do you fit into the cocktail?
Well,
party?
You're right. There's a no-fly zone over, most people in this country, but certainly not black males, not white Republican Christians. You can call them all sorts of names. You can call them Uncle Toms. You can call them sellouts. You can call them sugarcane Negroes. I have a laundry list of things I've been called. It's fascinating. It's just as racist to call somebody an Uncle Tom as it is for a white person to call somebody the N-word. What you're really saying is you as a black person do not have the right to have affection towards white people. And if you do so, there's something wrong with you, which is a slam on both whites and blacks. Your question, though, is how do I function here in California? Well, I have a two-step process I always tell people. I push for two things. I want us to keep the illegal aliens and deport the liberals. So I'm pushing for that agenda. Look, it's rough. This is a crazy state. There's not a single Republican that's elected statewide, Steve. Not one. Not a single one. And until the last election, we had a veto-proof Democratic majority legislature in Sacramento. So they could do any damn thing they want and did.
And do.
We got a $15 minimum wage out here in L.A. We just now passed it. And believe it or not, these freaking unions that push for it are seeking an exemption for firms that hire union workers. I am not making this up. If you are an employer and you have union workers, the very $15 minimum wage that the union pushed for, you have an exemption because you have union workers.
They didn't push for it.
What is that but an admission that higher minimum wage kills jobs? They're admitting it, and they do it anyway.
And meanwhile, the same unions are supporting the flood of illegal aliens over the southern border. I mean, that I don't get. I've got friends here. I'm in Michigan, a big union state. I've got a lot of friends that are in the union. I'm here in General Motors world, right, in Ford Motor Company. And the unions, much to the chagrin of people I know, are cheerleading this flood of illegals at the border. And it's crazy talk to me.
Well, here's why they do it, Steve. And a lot of people don't seem to get this. It isn't just that they're looking for votes, that is to say, eventually, some of these illegal aliens were going to become citizens, and they're going to vote likely 75% for Democrats. That's just one thing. That's way down the road. Right now, in most states, and I'm sure it's Michigan too, when you do redistricting to determine how many lawmakers you have, they count everybody, not just people who are eligible to vote, but everybody. Out here in California, they count everybody. So if you're an illegal alien, you are counted as a resident in the district towards determining how many Democrats, how many Republicans they have. There's a case right now before the Supreme Court trying to strike this down, and if it's stricken down, most people believe that Republicans are going to pick up a number of seats in the House.
Because you finally play fair, you know, but here you go again, Larry, thinking for yourself, how dare you, you know, who do you think, sit down and vote Democratic, that's your job, and that's what you should do. You talk about the message of race, and just the things that were said about Ben Carson here recently, one of the most accomplished people, doesn't matter if he's black or what, doesn't matter, one of the most accomplished people in the 20th century, in the 21st century, with his skills, his hand, his mind, and he gets run down.
He came out as a Republican. He was well received by the black community until he came out as a Republican, and now all of a sudden he's Darth Vader. Same guy. And, you know, and I've been accused of being born with a silver spoon in my mouth and all that stuff. My father was a janitor. He worked two full-time jobs as a janitor. My father does not know who his biological father is. My name, Elder, was the name of one of his mother's many boyfriends, the guy that stayed in his life the longest. My father was thrown out of his house when he was 13 years old by his mother because he quarreled with his mother's then-boyfriend. Mom sides with the boyfriend, throws my dad out of the house. We're talking about a black kid, 13 years old, Steve, Jim Crow South, Athens, Georgia, in the Great Depression. Never to return home. And my dad became a Pullman porter on the trains, and when World War II broke out, he was stationed in Guam, gets out, he was a cook, staff sergeant, gets out, goes back to the South to get a job as a cook, and he's told, we don't hire niggers. He then comes to California, where he had visited as a Pullman porter, and then he was told, you need references, which is California's more genteel way of saying we don't hire niggers. My dad even said, I work for you for free. Just give me a reference. Nobody would do it. So he took two jobs as a janitor, cooked for our family on the weekends, and went to night school to get his GED. I never saw a human being work that hard. And, Steve, the reason I'm telling you all of this is because my father's attitude was as follows. Hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. No matter how hard you work, bad things are going to happen. How you adjust to those bad things will tell your mother and me whether or not we raised a man. I'd always say, Dad, not too much pressure.
Yeah, no, I think that is a terrific story because hard work is what it's all about. And I think what we've lost in this country, by and large, is the work ethic. You know, exactly. everybody's a victim because listening to that story, your father was a victim. You know what? He didn't look at himself as a victim. He didn't consider himself a victim. And he sure as to hell didn't let you get away with that idea either.
That's right. And I wrote about him in my last book, Steve. It's called Dear Father, Dear Son. And the other thing my dad said, my dad was a Republican, by the way. My mom was a Democrat. It was fascinating watching them argue over the kitchen table. But my dad and my mom agreed on this. They both said the worst thing that ever happened to this country, the worst thing that ever happened to the black community was welfare. And that they said it encouraged women to marry the government and it allowed men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility. And both of them agreed on that. And that's exactly what's going on here. All this business about racism, 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 the reason the cops are there is because of crime. There's a disproportionately high amount of crime in the black community. That's why the cops are there. Obama said this, not Larry Elder. Obama said a kid raised without a father is 5 times more likely to be poor, 9 times more likely to drop out of school, 20 times more likely to end up in jail. Now do the math. 75% of black kids are born outside of wedlock right now. If they're 20 times more likely to end up in jail, what do you think is going to happen? And that's the problem. That's the problem. Unwed mothers, the implosion of families in the country, not just the black family, but the white family as well. 25% of white kids are born outside of wedlock. That number was about 5% in 1965.
It's all about the destruction of the family.
Absolutely.
Larry Elder, way to peel it back, my friend. If you want to hear more, and I know you do, LarryElder.com. LarryElder.com, the place to be. Great opening conversation, Larry. We're going to talk again soon, my friend. You are terrific and a great American. Thank you much.
Anytime.
Larry Elder, everybody. LarryElder.com. Take a breath. We'll be right back on the Steve Gruber Show.
The Steve Gruber Show. Get the news and information vital to your world.
At the hour on this Thursday, short week, does throw you off a little bit. Short week throws you off just a little bit. There's no question about that. So the Internal Revenue Service believes massive data, the theft of at least 100,000 people's information, may have originated behind the rusted iron curtain in Russia. Yes, the IRS believes that a major cyber breach that allowed criminals to steal the tax returns of more than 100,000 people came from Mother Russia. Two sources telling CNN and others that. Earlier this week, the IRS announced that organized crime syndicates used personal data obtained elsewhere to access tax information, which they then used to file $50 million in fraudulent tax refunds. The IRS said the agency's Criminal Investigation Unit and the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration are investigating the origins of the breach. The agency also alerted the Homeland Security Department of the breach, according to another DHS official. Now, an IRS spokeswoman said the agency does not discuss ongoing investigations, but this is It's unsettling. It's also a great argument for the flat tax. You see, because nobody could cheat the IRS and file fraudulent tax returns claims if you didn't get tax returns. You see, if you just paid 17% on a transaction fee every time you went and did whatever you did, there wouldn't be any tax returns. There wouldn't be any Internal Revenue Service. There wouldn't be any need for the Russians to break in and steal your information. Pretty simple. Common sense, right? Let's fix this. First of all, everybody would pay their fair share because everybody's interested in paying their fair share because the liberals want to make sure you pay your fair share, whatever that means. But the theft of this information by the Russians, to me, makes it perfectly clear. This is an opportunity to highlight the dangers of the tax system as it is, not only in the theft of information, but the theft of money. The theft of money outright from the American taxpayers, $50 million they tried to get. And this is just where they got caught. Who knows who got away with it for the last few years? Who knows who got away with, you know, bogus claims? Last year alone in the United States, $7 billion went out the door for fraudulent food stamp claims. That's right. $7 billion out the door for fraudulent food stamp claims. Well, if they can't control the food stamp system, do you really think they can control the IRS and the millions and millions of people that file there? Let's be honest. There's a report from an independent watchdog that called computer security the number one concern at the Internal Revenue Service, the number one problem they have. And it's been a problem since 1997, according to the report. For real, I can't make this. Since 1997, computer security has been a big crisis and a big problem with the Internal Revenue Service. And the new breach has lawmakers on Capitol Hill demanding answers. We want accessibility. Whatever. You're always demanding answers. You know what I'm demanding? Leadership. I'm demanding action. I'm demanding people that have the ability to do the hard work that it takes to run something. I want people that lie awake at night, not worrying about their reelection, but worrying about what it's going to take to get the job done, regardless of whether they get elected or not. I want politicians that lay awake at night worrying about whether they can get the job done. That's true at the federal level and the state level. I want state lawmakers here in Michigan lying awake at night making sure they can get the job done of fixing the roads, not whether or not they're going to get reelected next time around. I want them to have some pride. Pride in what they do. Not self-serving motivations, but pride in what they do. I want them to say, hey, listen, we were able to tighten our belt. We didn't get everything you wanted, but hey, we got some roads fixed here. And I want them to be proud of what they get done and what they accomplish. I want politicians at the federal level to look us in the eye and say, listen, we've been able to cut your taxes a little bit. We've been able to secure the border, make it a bit safer. And I want them to take pride in that job, not quibbling back and forth, not finger pointing, getting the job done. I want them to take pride in who they are and take pride in the fact that their constituents elected them to office, that they were sent there to do a good job, not just to beg for money and try to get reelected and posture for the cameras. Aren't you tired of self-serving politicians on both sides of the aisle? Because I'll tell you, I am. I'm ready for real leadership. And when I see the Internal Revenue Service breached, it makes me wonder, who's running this thing? Who's in charge? John Koskinen? The guy that said all those learners' emails are lost, never to be found again. And no, wait, we didn't open this drawer over here. Look, there's all our emails over here. This is transparency. I don't want people to talk about transparency. I don't want to hear it. I want them to demonstrate transparency. I want them to demonstrate honesty and ethics and hard work. I want the commander-in-chief to be... I want the commander-in-chief to be somebody we all want to emulate. Whether that's a man or a woman, black or white, I don't care. I want the commander-in-chief of the United States to be somebody that believes in this country, believes in hard work, believes in the American dream. The American dream being something you earn after a lot of hard work. Not something that's given to you or granted, or something you assume you have by birth, but something you earn. And many ways to do that. Whether it's coming from the poor side of the tracks or the house on the hill. If you contribute and give back through hard work, that's the American dream. It's not just having a big fancy car. It's making the place better by creating jobs or taking care of your neighbor or looking out for those in your community. There's a lot to it. And there's not one simple way to get there. So once again, I demand accountability. And this Internal Revenue Service breach makes me think, once again, the people that we have elected, the people we have trusted to send to office have breached our trust. It's not that the IRS was breached. It's that our trust in our government has once again been breached. And it's time for us to say enough. It's time for us to say, we hold you, the politicians, accountable. And not be swayed by some fancy message because they were able to collect more money than the next guy. The American dream is about hard work and how you get there. And what you accomplish and who you take care of along the way. It's not just about self-serving, self-interest, and greed. Enough of the narcissism. 41 after the hour, I'm Steve Gruber. I'll be right back.
Michigan's radio program of record is The Steve Gruber Show. Here is Steve Gruber.
It's 45 after the hour. I'm going to be a bit of a homer right now, so, you know, that's all right. I root for the home team. I like to spend money at the local hardware store when I can and not the box store. I like to promote the local football team if they're winning or the local girls basketball team if they're winning. I support the home team. And I'm going to do that right now because I'm going to support, you know, being a tourist in your own town. So for those of you listening statewide, that's okay. Because Lansing is the state capital. It's a place of history and politicians and a place where you can come and, you know, voice your concerns if you have those. And think about all the things that have happened here in Lansing over your lifetime. And if you've never seen the Capitol, my God, what a spectacular piece of architecture. Joining me now is Brendan Dwyer from the Lansing Convention and Visitors Bureau to talk about being a tourist in your own town. Now, we're talking about Lansing here. Of course, we broadcast all the way to the west end of the Upper Peninsula. But, Brendan, first of all, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
But when you talk about Lansing, I mean, there's three things here that I've always thought were I grew up in this area, but the three pillars of Lansing, if you will, are the state capital, Michigan State, and General Motors, which all have history here. And whether it's Ransom E. Olds and his history in this town or the capital, of course, Michigan State, the first land-grant institution in America, the first agricultural college, if you will. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of history. And for me, those are things that are interesting. But it has so much to offer in this area.
Oh, there is. There's just a ton to do. And, you know, for people that don't live in Lansing, so many people have connections or ties to Lansing.
Sure.
You know, they used to work here or, they send their kids to Michigan State and their money follows, right? So a lot of folks have ties to the Lansing area, even if they're not from here, and they come here and visit. And that's what we're hoping folks do. Saturday, May 30th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., we've got our Be a Tourist in Your Own Town event. And the real goal of it is to educate and inspire residents of Lansing that... to all that there is to see and do, and then encourage friends and family to come visit them. So,
and maybe for this particular case, well, it's tourist in your own town, but maybe in this case, it's be a tourist in your own state,
right?
Because maybe if you're listening in Traverse City this morning, or in Marquette, or wherever you might be listening, over in Flint, down in Kalamazoo, come see us here because we do have a lot to offer. So, and again, because we're the state capital, there are so many things that go along with that. We also have two fabulous rivers, you know, great lakes and opportunities as far as being outside as well.
So, yeah, I mean, the Michigan Historical Museum is a fantastic place.
Oh, it's awesome.
And you can spend a couple hours there alone. But we've also got, you know, you mentioned the rivers. We've got Rivertown Adventures is doing kayak rides that day. Just like I said, you buy your passport for a dollar and you can do all the things that are in it. You can get some golf lessons at Forest Acres, one of our beautiful golf courses here we have in the area. You can see the State Capitol building. It's going to be open for business for tours. And in fact, a very cool thing people should know, this Saturday is the first Saturday going forward. Capitol tours on Saturdays is starting up again. They stopped doing it for about 15 years. And they're now going to be doing tours of the state capitol for visitors on Saturdays.
No, that's terrific. Yeah. So you mentioned the Michigan Historical Museum, which I think is a phenomenal facility. So I talk about people coming here statewide, but there are displays there that talk, for example, about the timber industry in Michigan, which was basically anywhere from Mount Pleasant north. The mining industry has great resources there at the museum, talking about the mining and Copper Harbor and all the things that went on there. The automotive industry talks about Henry Ford and the different things, and of course, our hometown team of General Motors and all the evolution that the automotive industry went through. That's all the Michigan Historical Museum, which is it's a gem. It really is. It's like a collection of all things Michigan, from Mackinac Island to Monroe to Marquette and all things in between.
Absolutely. It's a fantastic stop. And in fact, if people are General Motors fans, there's two cool GM things going on. One, the R.E. Olds Museum is open that day, and there's all kinds of really cool Oldsmobile stuff there people will love to see. And also, General Motors is doing their ride and drive, so you can go to a certain spot, and they're going to have all the new line of GM vehicles, and you can test drive them that day with GM representatives, talk to them about the vehicles, peek under the engine, hop in a Camaro, and take it for a spin. So It's Lansing on its best day. Doors wide open for folks to visit and learn more, like you said, about our state capital and inherently the state.
We're not just at that Oldsmobile Museum here recently as well. And I was shocked at what I found inside those walls at the R.E. Olds Museum. I hadn't been in there. And the collection of cars that's in there, and the fact that Oldsmobile, that family and Ransom E. Olds himself, built big motors to drive other things before he put them into cars and so forth. He threshers for grain and so forth, and the whole history of what he did in this town and the different recreations of himself, if you will, as he evolved from a manufacturer on the small scale to becoming a manufacturer of automobiles. And that's a fascinating thing. If you like cars, if you're a gearhead, the REO is a very cool place to stop along the way. And not to mention, in Lansing, all the great development downtown, the restaurants, the shops, the places to grab a bite to eat, the unique eateries, all of those things are available as well.
Oh, absolutely. Shopping, dining, all that stuff is going on. Also, too, you know, all over the state are fans of the Michigan State Spartans. So how about come to Michigan State, check out the campus. There's all kinds of different things going on campus. You can do everything from get ice cream at the dairy store to go to the, you name it. Yeah. I mean, the doors are open.
You can walk. You can walk the banks of the Red Cedar as well. You can wear your Michigan hat, guys. Don't worry about it. You can wear your Michigan. It's cool. But you can walk the banks of the Red Cedar. My parents both went to Michigan State, so I have an affinity for Michigan State as well. And it is the largest, I believe, the largest physical campus of a university in the nation. Not the most students, but the largest physical campus. Plus all the things they do all over the state. Anybody, I don't care where you live in the state of Michigan, you see test plots and facilities that say Michigan State University on, whether it's pine trees or corn or beans. They're always out there trying to make things better for you and I, because that's what a land-grant college does. Brendan, one more time, where can people find out more information? Brendan Dwyer here from the Lansing Convention Visitors Bureau for Be a Tourist in Your Own Town, in our case in the state. Where can they find more info?
That's right. Just a quick visit to www.lansing.org. All the information's right there. We try and make it real simple. Over 90 local attractions open for you to check out Saturday, May 30th, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Come on and visit.
There you have it. Brendan Dwyer, everybody, from the Lansing CVB. That's the Convention and Visitors Bureau. It's on May the 30th. It's Be a Tourist in Your Own Town. In this case, come on down from Marquette to Manistee to Monroe to Milan. Come on in. We love you all. 51 after the hour. It's the Steve Gerber Show.